Good morning. Last week we began a series on the book of John, specifically talking about the statements in which Jesus says the word I am. There are seven of those. We often like to say because seven's a great Bible number, but there's technically eight, and so I'll say seven plus one to make it a little bit more convenient for us. What we're going to do is we've gone through two last week, we'll do two today and keep going until we're done. I think that's 4 weeks. I'm bad at math, so we'll figure that one out as we get through it. This morning, we're looking at the book of John, and we're looking at chapter 10, verse 9. The reason why these statements of I am is so special, in case you don't know, is the book of Exodus, chapter 3. In verse 17, we have the Lord responding from the midst of the burning bush, and the Lord is talking to Moses about why he is the one to go and to be the mediator between God's grace and mercy to redeem the people from Egyptian bondage and slavery. And Moses tries to go through a list of reasons why he's unqualified. And one of them was, if I go there and they don't believe me and they ask me, what is the Lord's name? I don't know your name. And he says, well, my name is Yahweh or Jehovah, but really it literally means I am who or I am that I am. And so that great I am statement is spoken by the angel of the Lord, likely referencing the idea of Jesus before he's known as Jesus, as the second person of the Godhead. So whenever we have the second person of the Godhead say a statement in John that I am something, he's not only saying, here is how I identify myself, in a particular, very specific way, he's also alluding to the fact that he also is Yahweh. He is God. He is the Lord. He is the I am that I am. And so, last time we talked about the great I am statements of I am the bread of life, or I am the life-giving bread. And he is saying he's the fulfillment of that manna sent from heaven in the book of Exodus. They received physical bread and were filled physically. He is the spiritual bread that will fill you and satisfy you completely in a holistic and spiritual sense. And also, I am the light of the world. He's going to talk about the light once again in our context. He is the light-giving essence of this world, not only in creation, as we saw in John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, he made physical light in the beginning, but also he gives light to those who are in the darkness of sin. And so that was our text from last week. And so we're building upon that each week as we get to kind of the ending of it. And we're going to end in John chapter 8, in case you want to go ahead and read ahead and see why chapter 8 is so special. So today, to talk about John chapter 10 and verse 9 specifically, we want to begin in John chapter 9, verse 1, to get some context. Because if we just read the verse, we'll say, like I mentioned last Sunday, that's a great line. We see it's powerful. He says he's something very special. Great. But he drops these little bombs of the I am statements along these events that take place in his public ministry. And so he leaves the idea of I am the door of the sheep, and that's his concluding statement to the situation that took place in chapter 9. So, I've been going a little bit longer than I intend when it comes to my Sunday morning sermon, so I'm going to try to keep myself at a decent pace. All right, so, chapter 9, verse 1. And as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Christ said, it is not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Which, of course, is a kind of a throwback to our previous context of him being the light of the world, right? And verse 6, having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with his saliva. Ew, right? Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said, go wash in the pool of Siloam. And so he went and he washed and he came back seeing. Now there have been numerous attempts to try to define and describe and to explain why in the world Jesus was so gross here in this context. Why did he spit on the ground, make mud, and wipe it on some guy's eyes? That just seems excessive. Now, the answer is, we don't know. We can ask Christ if we still care when we see him next. But there are some theories here that I think make a little bit of sense. We know that Christ could just say something, just speak it into existence and say, now you're no longer blind, or open your eyes, you can see. He can heal people that way. So why go through the extra process here of making the mud and wiping it on his eyes, I would hope his eyelids, and then have him go wash in the pool of Siloam? Well, there's some symbolism here, as there often is. We know that in the book of Genesis, when describing how mankind was formed, Moses was inspired to write that we were formed of the dust or the dirt of the ground. And so our physical bodies are made up of the same elements that we find in our physical creation. That which makes us special or different or distinct than other animals, if you will, in the world, is the fact that God then breathed into his nostrils the pneuma, the breath, the spirit of life, and man became a living soul. So we have the combination of a physical body made of the dirt of the earth, if you will, and the breath of God, the spirit of God giving life to us, makes us have a soul. And what we find here is something kind of similar to that. You find him taking the dirt of the earth and using, if you will, his breath, his spirit, his physical essence of that which he uses to breathe and to speak, you might say saliva, and he forms those two things together to bring about a healing for this man that was blind. Does that really explain it? Maybe not entirely. I still have questions, but this is one thought that I find has the most bulk to it, the most merit to it, that I wanted to share with you as a theory. So, whatever the case, this man was blind, but now he can see, right? Verse 8, the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? And some said, it is. Others said, no, he just looks like him, which I love, because you can just kind of see our own humanness in those little comments. He kept saying, yeah, I'm the man. I am the man. Verse 10, so then he said to him, then how were your eyes opened? Because folks apparently didn't see it. He answered, the man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. And so he went and he washed and I received my sight. They said, where is he? He says, I don't know. Now there's going to be some irony in this context. And that's kind of the point. Is you have a man who was unable to see physically, and we call him blind. And then Jesus came along, the light of the world, he gave him his spirit, his breath, his healing, and he was now able to see. We're about to meet some folks who could see, but they were just as blind as that blind man was in a spiritual sense. So let's keep reading here, verse 13. Then they brought to the Pharisees the man who had been formerly blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. Now, in the very end of chapter 8, the previous chapter, we find the Pharisees hearing some truth bombs from Christ there, and they were picking up stones to try to kill Jesus, and he just left. And now we have this taking place on the Sabbath day, which they would contend was an actual work or unnecessary work. And so they're trying to pin Christ down as being someone who cannot be the Messiah because he breaks the Old Testament law. Christ didn't do that. That's their contention, though. In verse 15, so the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes, I washed, and I see. And some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him since he has opened your eyes? He said, he is a prophet. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he see? His parents answered, We know that this is our son, and that he was born blind. But how he sees now, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he's of age, he will speak for himself. Now you read this, is three times now, they're trying to go through this story, checking out all the alibis, all the events, and they're looking for something that isn't there. You might call them blind leaders of the blind, as Jesus often did. They're looking for an excuse, a reason to pin that what Jesus did wasn't from God, nor was it appropriate for a man who is blind, but now he can see. So there's that irony there that they are just as blind as this formerly blind man was. Verse 22, his parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the anointed one, to be the Messiah, he was to be put out of the synagogue. And so they, again, were blind, saying, this guy can't be the Messiah because we don't want him to be the Messiah. And so if you think he's the Messiah, you're out of our club, they would say. Verse 23, therefore his parents said, he's of age, ask him. So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. He answered, whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. I don't have that accent, but I was trying to be louder than him for a while. Verse 26, they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? As if they didn't already know what they already asked him. Verse 27, he answered them, I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? And then I love this. I would love to know his intention. Do you also want to become his disciples? Are you asking because you want to follow him? The answer to that is no. His retort might be something kind of along the lines of, well, why wouldn't you? I was blind, and now I can see this guy healed me. I want to follow him. What's your excuse? Verse 28, then they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he comes from. Now, he already told them before he came from heaven to save them from their sins. He's the Messiah, healing people left and right, but they are completely blind to who he truly is. That's why these I am statements are so important, because he's revealing himself through different modes, different expressions, different ways to try to point them to the fact that he is the one, but they've blinded themselves. Okay, verse 30. The man answered, why, this is an amazing thing. You don't know where he comes from. Yeah, he opened my eyes. So now you got a blind man trying to show the Pharisees how blind they truly are. We know that God does not listen to sinners. But if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. So he's just showing them, why can't you see what I can now see about this man, Jesus? They answered, you were born in utter sin, and you would teach us? So they cast him out. Now this is an important kind of connection to make. We're in Romans and on Sunday mornings. And the conclusion of chapter 3 basically is that Jews and Gentiles both have fallen short of the glory of God. They're all in sin. So if you listen to verse 34, you get the kind of mindset that Paul, or the Holy Spirit through Paul, is trying to impart. You were born in utter sin, being blind. The Pharisees, they wouldn't sin because they're too good for that. But you see here the reality that they actually have committed sin by blinding themselves. Verse 35, Jesus heard that they had cast him out, meaning of the synagogue. And having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Now keep in mind here the kind of context, right? As far as we know, Christ walks over, makes mud, puts it on his eyes, gives him directions, go to the pool of Siloam, and then Christ is gone. He comes back seeing. He's never seen Jesus before, physically, it would seem from the context. So Jesus kind of comes back and says, hey, remember me? Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Verse 37, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. He says, Lord, Adonai, my master, I believe. And he worshiped him. Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. We'll talk about exactly what happened in the previous context. Someone who is blind but had faith was healed. People that could see were blinded because of their own sin and ignorance. That's the dichotomy here between these two groups. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? Well, who do you think I'm talking about? Verse 41, Jesus said, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. He says, you are blinding yourselves to your own sin and guilt. If you came through a contrite heart and repentant mercy and asked for belief, that would make you not blind, but able to be seen. And then chapter 10, verse 1. Truly, truly, I say to you. Last Sunday morning, I mentioned how that is him specifically saying, you need to listen very carefully to what I'm about to tell you. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. Now, culturally here, we're a little bit away from this, so I want to explain the best I can. They would often have these groups and these pens, if you will, made from stones that were in a circle, and you place your sheep there. You put your sheep there among other sheep of other shepherds for protection in the night. And there would be a gap in the stone wall upon which you would find someone who was hired to stand guard and protect the sheep. Meaning, if you've got someone who's trying to just take one sheep and eat it, someone trying to steal other people's sheep, they'd have to go through the gatekeeper. They'd have to be through that hired man who was the guard for others' property. Also, you would have sticks and thorns and briars placed on top of the walls to prevent the goats from jumping out. The goats would jump, the sheep often would not. And so you have these kind of two illustrations of, you know where you store your sheep, how there's always one door you have to go through, and there's a gatekeeper there protecting the flock, and no one can really get in who's not a thief or a robber through the front door. That's verse 2. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him, the gatekeeper, the guard, opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And so he's saying, you know how that works when you have a bunch of sheep and not all of them are yours, but you are the shepherd and you walk over to the gatekeeper, he gives you access. They hear your voice and then they follow you out. You know that illustration that we see time and time again in the ancient culture? Verse 4, when he has brought all of his own out, he goes before them, and the sheep will follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they don't know the voice of the strangers. And then verse 6, this figure of speech Christ used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. What he's saying is, if people are following me as the shepherd, they recognize my voice in the most metaphorical way possible. They see what I do, how I do it, and by whose power I do this, and they recognize me for being a prophet, for being the Christ, and they want to follow me. Are you not picking up what I'm putting down, Pharisees? You're not hearing my voice. You're looking at all the evidence, but you're blind to it. You are not wanting to hear my voice to follow me. You want to lead. You're the thief and the robber who wants to steal the Lord's sheep from him. In verse 7, he said, truly, truly, I say to you, listen very carefully. I am the door of the sheep. If you want to be in the flock of God, if you want to be with all the other sheep that belong to the Lord, there's only one way to get into that place of protection, and that's through Jesus the Christ. But they didn't want to find that door. They were looking for ways to get in the flock of God, the people of God, without going through the door, and that was impossible. Christ is trying to explain to them in a very clear way, you're looking to get into the flock of God, but you don't want to go through the only opening there is. And that's why you are blind. But that blind man you met earlier, he knows there's only one way in. He says, Lord, Adonai, I believe, and he worshiped. And he's in the flock of God. So the irony here of a man who is blind but now can see, and now he can see Jesus, versus the folks that were with Christ more than anybody else who were blinding themselves to the reality of who this man was. It just goes to show how the foolishness of God is used to bring out those that are looking for the truth. Now, let's close our thoughts out with one more passage here. It's in the book of Psalms. Psalm 118 specifically. There's a whole lot more that can be said, but we're going to have to, just for sake of time and convenience, just pop over here. I want to read this passage, knowing what we know about who Christ is, being the door of the sheep, being the one who is, later tonight, the Good Shepherd. And he's the one who's trying to reveal himself in this kind of way. Look at what the psalmist says here. Psalm 118, beginning in verse 17. He says, I shall not die, but I shall live and recount the deeds of the Lord. That Lord there is all caps, lower font, meaning Yahweh, the great I am. Verse 18, the great I am has disciplined me severely, but he has not given me over to death. Open to me, verse 19, the gates of righteousness, that I may enter through them and give thanks to the great I am. This is the gate of the Lord. The righteous shall enter through it. And I thank you that you have answered me and have become my salvation. The stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone, which is talking about Christ. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. The psalmist here is capturing the exact picture we get from John chapter 10. You've got someone who was given a bad hand from birth. He was born blind. The Lord has dealt with me severely, but not over to death. And then he sees the gates of righteousness open through the actions of the Lord. And then he goes in those gates, and the Lord is there to give him salvation. And he sees all of that as the great blessing from the great I am. All these connections are made throughout Scripture that point us to who the Messiah is. And Christ is calling out for all of these passages to be remembered and to be applied correctly. And so for this morning, the question is yours. Are you blind to who Jesus truly is? Or can you see him as the door of the sheepfold? If you are not in the flock of God, if you're not a follower of Jesus Christ, there is only one way to get into the family of God, and that's through the door, Jesus the Christ. If we can help you enter the family of God this morning, respond by coming forward now as we stand and we sing.